Good afternoon. I'd like to welcome you to Track 1, Embracing the Changing Business of Law, Insights and Ideas for a Stronger Tomorrow. Our first speaker, Paul Morton, is the current executive director of Burns & Levinson, a 125-firm law firm with offices in Massachusetts, Rhode Island, and New York. Paul has managed small firms, as small as 10, mid-size, and large firms. He's worked in San Francisco, Wilmington, Delaware, as well as Boston. He's also a distinguished member of the Association of Legal Administrators and has been active on the board at the local, regional, and international level. Having Paul as part of the PLL Summit is furthering the AALL-PLL initiative of partnering with the Association of Legal Administrators. And I hope that through this partnership, we are able to give our administrators a better idea of what we can bring to our organizations. So with that, Paul Morton is going to tell us about what keeps the C-suite up at night. Paul?
Thank you. Thank you very much for inviting me to speak with you today. I wanted to take a minute or two just to tell you a bit about my background and sort of establish some credentials for speaking to an impressive group of librarians. I should tell you that when I was in elementary school, my mother was at that time an elementary school teacher and then went to Queens College in New York City where she got her MLS. Queens College, yeah. So I was raised both by an educator and by a librarian. And so I developed at that time a great, is that on? A little closer? Okay. So I developed at that time, a passion both for books and for libraries. In high school, I looked back the other day at my high school yearbook, and I noticed that the only thing it said next to my name in terms of accomplishments was library monitor. It also said a couple of other things, but that was the one that sort of stuck out. I spent a lot of my free time there in the library. Now, jump forward a few years. In 1980, I had just joined my second law firm in Wilmington, Delaware. I had been managing a very small firm in San Francisco initially. And I got there, and we had a library, but we did not have a librarian, which made absolutely no sense to me. So I hired one. And of course, the partners at that time said, what are you spending money on a librarian for? You can't justify this full time. So we expanded the role slightly. We, at that time, in addition to all the traditional print materials that we had in the library, we had what we refer to as a legal brief file. Anybody remember those? And so she was in charge of that as well. And we then expanded her role to also be in charge of records. And the underlying concept that I used to sell at that time was that legal briefs and records were simply research materials that were created internally, and library books were research materials that were created externally. Over the years, I've hired librarians, I've designed libraries, I've expanded them, I've contracted them, I've negotiated with Lexis and Westlaw and pretty much everybody else out there. I've created chargeback systems, I've eliminated chargeback systems. I've been managing and leading law firms for over 30 years. The only thing a distinguished ALA member means is that you've been in the ALA for a long time and you're relatively old. Doesn't mean that you're really distinguished. But libraries and library management have always been a big part of my life. And yet, I've always seen that the role of the library and the librarian in a law firm is understated. It doesn't get the kind of attention that IT gets. It doesn't cause the kinds of problems that human resources needs to deal with all the time. Libraries simply provide information that the attorneys need, and the librarians are expected to work their magic to get what the attorneys need almost instantaneously, and of course, find a way not to charge the client for it. Now, we all know the old adage that knowledge is power. Given that, I sometimes wonder why librarians aren't the most powerful and important people in a law firm. But I guess you can only have knowledge if you have information access. So how do you know where the library fits into the overall scheme of things? What challenges are our organizations facing? What kinds of things do legal administrators or managing partners worry about regarding the future? And how do you take that knowledge once you get it and help you manage your libraries more effectively? How can the librarian really become the core of knowledge in the law firm and be the person or persons to whom everybody turns when they need information about anything? Now, being completely candid, preparing for this presentation today was more fun than preparing for other presentations I've had to do over the years, because I was asked to talk about what keeps me up at night. So it's, what am I worried about? What do I think about? So you're not going to see spreadsheets. You will not see any charts. You will not see, you know, arrows and paragraphs and other things like that. You're not going to see, here's a presentation of problems and here are our recommendations for fixing them. You will see, hopefully, a stream of issues, of challenges, all of which are incredibly interrelated. The things that we need to deal with every day, it requires leaders' constant attention and thought, and it's going to continue challenging us for years to come. Now, I know what keeps me up at night, but I also wanted to find out, to get a bigger perspective, so I reached out to a number of large law firm administrators throughout the country to get their input. And I found out, I wanted to see, how widespread are my nightmares? What are the monsters under my bed, and are they the same as the monsters under everybody else's bed? So these comments will reflect everybody's common monsters. Now, the first one is dealing with change. The only constant that we seem to have is that everything is changing constantly. Things are different today than they were yesterday. They're going to be different again tomorrow. Obviously, we all know this, and apparently this was one of the themes in one of the sessions this morning. But I think if you've spent any time in a law firm or working with lawyers, you know that lawyers and law firms historically do not react well to change. Perfect example. So let's explore this a little bit. The law, as it is taught, is based on precedent. Whenever we look to see what should be done, we always go back and look at what was done. What did we do before? In essence, that's the crux of what a library is all about. It's looking at what base of knowledge have we gathered over the years, and how do we use that knowledge to decide what we are going to be doing going forward? How many times have you seen, when you're looking at introducing a new product, a new vendor, a new book, a new series, your partners will come back and say, but what is everybody else doing? What is a law firm down the street doing? They don't want to be the first. There is a comfort and a predictability in relying on past behavior to predict future behavior. That's what law school teaches, and that's what our lawyers know. In a recent presentation by the Center for Competitive Management, the speaker commented that in law school, you spend 3 years learning about individual and independent behavior and thought. In business school, however, you will spend your 2 years in business school learning about teamwork. And every project that you will do in business school is focused on a team. Two totally and completely different approaches to the thought process. How do you approach things? Now, law firms have been for many, many years trying to operate like businesses. And that means that our partners need to think like businessmen or businesswomen. But by asking people to behave in a way that is different than what they were taught, is different from how they have practiced in the past, differs from their training, it's proposing a major upheaval. For many people, doing something outside of your comfort zone is just really, really hard. Unlike other industries where the leaders are taught to be flexible and sometimes even daring, lawyers simply are not taught to do that. Again, look at this. This is the history of what lawyers think about. As one of my fellow administrators said, in this time of heavy change in the profession, how do we get attorneys who detest change to embrace it? How do we get them to actively and eagerly try to do things differently? Getting lawyers to be receptive to change is, to say the least, challenging. I know you've all heard the phrase, managing lawyers is like herding cats. Think about herding not a group of nice little sweet domestic cats. Think about herding a group of lions and tigers with really, really sharp teeth and claws. Selling to a group of lawyers is different than selling to a group of business people because of the way that they think. And it's different whether you're selling a product or even more importantly, whether you are selling an idea. So this whole concept of change and dealing with change is the monster under the bed for me that affects everything else. It's the biggest monster that's there because change permeates everything that we do. And the biggest challenge is, first, do we even recognize it? Second, if we do, how do we face it? How do we understand it? And then how do we deal with it? So let's talk a little bit about financial and business issues, because this underlies everything. We start off with the basic question, are we a profession or are we a business? Have you guys all heard that posed before? Lawyers are professionals. They are not businessmen. But the answer, whether you think of yourselves, yes, we are a business, or that we are a combination of a business and a profession, either way, as long as you're not saying we are only a profession, it requires a change in mindset from what most of the lawyers have. And they need to buy into that decision. They need to recognize that what they are, how they think of themselves, is going to drive or stall all subsequent behavior. Has anybody ever heard a partner say, I went to law school to become a lawyer. If I wanted to be a businessman, I would have gone to business school. That's not what I wanted to be. Now they, whoever they might be, is telling me that I have to operate in a business-like fashion. I don't want to do that. Anybody ever hear lawyers say things like that? Many partners would be happy if they could sit in their offices or their courtroom or wherever they wanted to practice and never think about the business side of the practice. And yet, while we have to operate in a business-like fashion, nonetheless, lawyers and law firms are subjected to certain laws and guidelines that regular businessmen are not. So we have to behave in a certain way, and it's often contradictory to what good business sense will tell you. So one could be altruistic and say, law firms exist to serve their clients, to provide legal counsel to those in need. That's what we would like to think. And in many instances, that's true. That's a driving force. But it's not always the driving factor. It should be. You'd like to think it would be. That's the high-level concept. But sometimes there is a secondary purpose that takes precedence. Making money. Now, if a law firm or an organization doesn't make money, if it doesn't thrive as a business, then it really can't fulfill its initial purpose of serving clients. So there's a constant paradox that we are juggling all the time. What do you do, for example, if you have a good client, you need to service them, and the client either can't or won't pay the bill? The business person says, cut them off. The lawyer says, I'm going to continue sinking more money into this case no matter what. Again, it's a paradox that we struggle with. But as a chief information officer, an IT guy who I've worked with over the years, once said to me, when dealing with the day-to-day craziness of running a law firm and all the angst that we were feeling, he said, let's not lose perspective. We're not saving lives here. We're just helping a bunch of rich guys make more money. That sort of puts it in context. So where does the worry about the business side come in? Where are the monsters? While most lawyers accept that law firms have to operate as a business, they're not happy about it. Most go along grudgingly at best, and law firm leaders are constantly struggling of how to get the partners to comply with good business practices. We all know what those are. We've all heard the stories. Turn your timesheets in on time. Whether you're using a carrot, though, whether you're using a stick or some kind of a combination, what lawyer leaders, law firm leaders, are needing to do is to change behavior. M&Ms don't always work. Behavior modification is what we're trying to do here. Changing the underlying mindset is what we need to do. One of my counterparts in another law firm said, many of our partners lack an understanding of the fundamental economics of a law firm and the economics of law business in general. Said another, lawyers are not trained as business people. We need to constantly educate them and teach them how to think in a way that is often contrary to what their training is. We need to convince the partners that a firm has to be run like a business because this is how our competitors are doing it. Now, our industry has over many, many years experienced significant growth and often huge increases in income for the partners. And many partners developed an idea or a concept that every year your income had to go up. If it didn't go up, you were not being successful. Unfortunately, this attitude sometimes drove inappropriate business practices. So, one of the challenges, one of the monsters, we need to carefully manage the expectations of our partners and equally our staff, because the business climate today will simply no longer allow the kind of constant increase in compensation and earnings. You may have heard the expression, flat is the new up. That's the new mantra in law firms. If your income is staying the same, you're doing pretty well. Our industry has seen a lot of consolidation in the past decade, and we are likely to see more going forward. The consultants, the pundits out there, have said that the rate of mergers and acquisitions in the legal industry accelerated significantly in 2011 after a lull for the 2 years before that, and is likely to continue in 2012. So potential mergers, acquisitions, consolidations, the weeding out of weaker players, the concern about holding your place in the lexicon of law firms. This haunts many of us. Those are monsters. And now, there's a new monster that we are all contending with. Come back. What does this mean to us? Were the problems that this law firm experienced unique to them? I guess for the record, we're talking about Dewey and LaBeouf. Do many of us have in our institutions, our organizations, some of the telltale signs? Will this cause us to look at the way we do things ourselves, or will it be in our firms, same old, same old? Again, how do we deal with the forces of change? Are the ongoing open-ended expectations of increasing compensation for partners causing behaviors that are individualistic as opposed to what's in the best interest of the organization? Think about the portability of a practice, the ability and the desire to move from one firm to another, sometimes like that. The perception that the grass is always greener, this tends to make partners hoard their clients and hoard their work, because if they control it, if it's just theirs, then they can pick up and move down the street. It will enhance an individual's value. Again, think back to the concept of individual behavior as opposed to group behavior. It affects how they then function. It affects marketing. Do they market individually or do they market as part of a team? It affects sharing. Are we going to do this collaboratively or not? It affects group behavior. Do we put together an effective team to service a client or not? And it affects loyalty and it affects commitment, something that partners sometimes don't always have these days. So one of our challenges then, how do we plan for the future? And how do we build a firm where the partners won't feel that they want to take a call when the hunter rings and says, come down the street, you can make more money. The marketplace now that we sell our services in is broader and more diverse than ever before. One doesn't need to have offices in Hong Kong or in London to be international. Your clients, even if they are based in your local hometown, are often selling internationally. They hire people from overseas. They have patents across the world. So we are dealing with different kinds of competition than ever before, even if it seems like we have a local practice. And we're seeing more competition from outside sources. Law firms from different cities or from different countries are now coming into your territory. Not only are they competing for the clients, they're competing for your best people. They're hiring your people away. That's how they start up. And we are also competing with people outside the legal industry, consultants, brokers, paralegal institutions, places that will provide many of the same services that we do, and usually for less money. And keep in mind again that these organizations that are coming into your territory are constantly calling up your people to lure them away. Another dynamic of this, as law firms have changed to real business models, as we are changing away from a true partnership to a corporate style model, partners very often will feel disenfranchised. They used to feel in control. Now they feel that they have to work more hours, they have to produce more, they have to be more efficient. And many of the corporate models are cutting away the weaker players who have not been able to adapt. Now, how does the economy affect our clients? Whether our clients are Fortune 100 companies or individuals or small businesses or mom and pop businesses, everybody has to reconsider what their legal spend is, how much money they are going to commit to the legal issues that they contend with. Everybody is looking to get more for less. We know that. The clients are becoming increasingly more demanding. Many are requiring budgets or fixed fees. You've all heard the phrase alternate fees, alternate fee arrangements. Unfortunately, many clients tend to think that an alternate fee arrangement simply means a reduced fee arrangement. It's not the way it's supposed to be. They don't want to pay anymore for the training of young attorneys. They don't want to pay for perceived duplication of work. If you're having an internal conference in the office, you can only bill for one person. Might as well talk to yourself. They're unwilling to pay for expenses, whether the expenses are photocopies or legal research. They're looking for greater and more frequent discounts. Now, none of this is unreasonable. We as business people are looking for the same thing for the providers who give us services. But what it does bring into question is the definition of value. The definition of value, what we bring to the table, is different today than it used to be. But nobody really knows for sure what a client thinks value is. And that's one of the challenges that we have. We have to demonstrate and provide value, but we don't always know what it is that we're being asked to provide. Law firms simply are no longer the money machines they used to be, and we have to look carefully at our clients. We have to consider whether or not there are clients that we should fire. There are some consultants that will tell you, every year fire your bottom 10% of your clients. I like to think, and my librarians who are here today cringe when I say this, I say the same thing applies to personnel. Get rid of the people who are not performing. Get rid of the clients who are not performing. We have to be more selective about our clients. And to do that, we have to have more information about who these clients are. Now, this is an incredibly great opportunity for librarians because you can provide additional services to your firms by using your research capabilities to support the firm in its client development opportunities. You can work with your marketing department. You can work with partners when they are going out to do marketing, not just by finding out about the company, but finding out about the financial viability of the individual or the company. See whether or not a company is a good business risk. Most of that information is public record. Most of the attorneys don't think about or know about how going to look for it. You do. It's a great opportunity for you to provide additional value to your partners. And yet there's a conundrum. Partners are told they have to bring in more business, so they don't like to say no to a prospective client. We all hear pretty constantly, any client is better than no client. A reduced fee is better than sitting and twiddling your thumbs because you have nothing else to do. But the alternative to that is trying to match the number of lawyers that you have to the volume of work that you have, which might result in fewer number of lawyers. That's something that most law firms don't want to hear. We're being forced to look at how we operate, how we can improve our efficiency, how do we control our costs, how do we enhance our profits. Unfortunately, this often relies more and more on technology. We need to do that, but because we can't charge the clients back, there is less of an ability to recoup the investments on technology that we are seeing. So we need to make it available and find ways that it just gets built into the overhead. Now, over the last few years, many law firms achieved whatever profit margins they had by cutting costs, reducing expenses. We've seen that in personnel, in layoffs. We've seen that in reduced salary increases. We've seen that, you guys have seen that in being told to cut the budgets in the library. We've seen it in postponing investments in technology. We have not generally seen it in increases in gross revenues. But that can only go on for so long before your infrastructure and your staff can't continue to provide what the lawyers and the law firms need. So we have to find out, how do we change that model? It's a catch-22. You have to spend money to be able to make money, but nobody wants to spend money because their partners want to take it home. We worry about our partners being able to accept that they need to change. It's again that same initial premise. One of my fellow administrators said, I am concerned because our attorneys, for the most part, do not know how to budget. Many do a poor job at project management, particularly the old school litigators who approach a matter by committing all assets without any upfront triage, or damn the torpedoes full speed ahead. The unwillingness to listen, the inability to learn new tricks. The economics of the business of law change, and they don't. That's a big monster under the bed. And then exacerbating this problem is the fact that the business partners, the vendors that we deal with, are changing as well. not only have law firms seen consolidation, but the business partners that we work with have seen consolidation. I'm sure you'll remember that there used to be individual companies that sold marketing software, individual companies that sold books, individual companies that sold financial software, that sold online research tools. Now, those products, those services are all consolidated in the hands of a few large companies. So when we used to be able to pick and choose what we thought was the best product and the best value for our firms, we're not as easily able to do that anymore. And so when the disparate products are all in the hands of one vendor, it minimizes competition and it reduces our bargaining power. So we're being told to cut costs, and our business partners are exerting more and more control. An image that affects this, I had a long discussion using this image a couple of days ago with one of the senior people at one of the big business providers, and we'll leave them unnamed for the moment. But have you guys seen a recent commercial on TV for a phone company called Vonage? And this jumped out at me. There's a lovely couple in their house, and another couple knocks on the door, and the woman knocking on the door is standing there holding a puppy. And the guy standing next to her is holding stuff, whatever it might be. And the people on the inside said, no, thank you, we're using Vonage. We don't need a bundle program. But we want to sell you everything. But I don't need it. But we want to sell you everything. We don't need it. Oh, what a cute puppy. Can I touch it? No, the puppy's part of the bundle. So how many of you guys want the puppy without getting the whole bundle? It puts us into a very difficult position. And I'm sure almost everybody, if not everybody in this room, has seen this in your recent negotiations. So where does this position you as the librarian? With the change from print media to electronic media, I believe that the library has changed from a place to a concept. Knowledge simply is everywhere. What we need to deal with is the management of the knowledge. By understanding the business and the personnel issues that the law firm leaders are facing, you will be better positioned to figure out how to get them the knowledge that they need to do their jobs. You can tie your tools, your research tools and skills as a librarian, to provide help to marketing, to business development, to personnel management, to potential client assessment. You can help the attorneys and the business leaders understand how to get the information they need to make the business decisions. It's moving in terms of true knowledge management. By understanding what they value, you can understand how to add that value, which strengthens your position. It's not just the savings you might achieve in negotiating a better contract, although trust me, that's important. Every time my librarians come back and say they saved me money on a contract, it makes me smile. But when they could provide that added value, it makes it even better. So is anybody feeling any monsters peeping out from under the bed right now? Let's talk a little bit about business development and marketing. At the end of each year, no matter how good a year the previous one was, even the best of business originators will say, where are my clients coming from next year? It's not like you have this stock of business that you're always counting on. Every year you're struggling to bring in more clients and more business. It's a never-ending challenge, and it's one that I worry about all the time. Let's be real. Look at the number of law firms represented in this room. There are an awful lot of very, very good law firms out there. There's an incredible number of talented lawyers. Why are the clients going to choose us rather than somebody else? We need to be asking ourselves that all the time. In a really tight economic environment, like the one that we've been in for the last few years and are likely to be in going forward, it's really hard to find new clients. Any existing company already has legal counsel. So if you want to get them, you're going to be stealing them away from existing counsel. So you need to find a way to show why you are better. New companies with business, new business who don't have legal counsel, they're few and far between. And unfortunately, many of them are startups and they simply don't have any money. Anybody remember Wimpy from the Popeye? I'll gladly pay you Tuesday for a hamburger today. How many have clients like that? Gladly pay you next year for legal services this year. So I worry about where our future clients are coming from. I really worry about who is trying to steal our clients. because we're trying to steal clients from other lawyers and other law firms. I worry about whether we are going to be doing enough to market our attorneys and the firm, and I worry about whether or not we are doing the right things and enough of the right things. We struggle with a perception of return on investment. Everybody wants to get an ROI, but how do you get an ROI on a marketing event when a person that you meet today may give you business not tomorrow, but 3 years from now? How do you know whether you're investing your time and energy and marketing money in a valuable way? Some of our partners don't see value in marketing at all. They simply say, as long as you do good legal work, clients will come. Really? Not anymore. On the other hand, we have lawyers who want to spend more and more time doing marketing, but aren't really good at it. So how do we support the people, everybody, because everybody wants to do something, how do we support the ones who are going to be most valuable? I'm sure you know we all have lawyers who are natural marketing people. Others can learn the skills. And then there are the backroom lawyers. Terrific, very talented, but you never want to stick them in front of a lawyer, in front of a client. Anybody have anybody like that? Partners all are feeling pressure to generate business, even if they don't have the skills and the personalities. So one of our monsters is, how do we use our limited resources to choose among the partners where we're going to provide support, how we're going to figure out what type of support, and how we're going to maximize the return on it. One administrator said, attorneys really need to engage to become rainmakers and to figure out where future clients are coming from. I believe our partners need to have a greater sense of urgency about these things. And not only do partners need to sell themselves outside the firm, they need to sell themselves inside the firm. And that's one of the things that they often forget about. So our monster is, how do we adequately support the partners who are good at marketing? How do we help attorneys who might not be good, but at least reasonable into marketers? And to me, most important, how do you develop the superstars who will be the future rainmakers? And of course, marketing ties into compensation. Do our compensation systems properly motivate and reward partners for their marketing efforts and for the successes in marketing? So now, if you can see this, this is the three-headed monster of partnership, leadership, and compensation. If we truly care about our law firms and about the industry, then we shouldn't be worrying just about this year's profits. We shouldn't be worrying just about what's going to happen tomorrow. We should be thinking as caretakers of the industry. How do we create an environment in our firms that will last long into the future, so the names will carry on even after the current partners aren't there anymore? This is one of my nighttime thoughts. I worry about this a lot. Being a partner in a law firm, now it's easy to quantify this as an outsider because I'm one of those non-lawyers. I'm not a partner. We all know the difference between a lawyer and a non-lawyer, so we don't have to go there for the moment. But being a partner in a law firm should mean something. It should mean something beyond just compensation and prestige. So how do we develop a concept of ownership mentality among the partners or the shareholders in our firms? The underlying question is, why should we as management have to create that among the partners? But the reality of it is that they don't always do it themselves. In a day and age when law firms are often larger and a partner's vote has less and less meaning, there are many partnerships where the partners never vote on anything. Partners may feel more like employees than decision makers. So how do we help them in that environment to feel that their behavior still has to reflect a pride in ownership? It still has to be decisions that are made in the firm's best interest. Being a partner implies equality, but I think we all know that not all partners are created equally. How do we find our practice group leaders? How do we get them to balance the load of managing the other attorneys in their practice groups and still being profitable business lawyers? A lot of our best rainmakers are the best leaders. How do we prioritize their time? What do we get more bang for the buck out of, marketing or out of leadership? Think about serving as a managing partner. The skills that make a good managing partner are not always the same skills that make a good lawyer. How effective our current managing partners are, who is going to take over either when their terms run out or when they no longer want to serve as managing partner? How do we ensure that the leaders of the firm are trained and knowledgeable about the many things they need to deal with, which have nothing to do with the practice of law that they are taught? This is, again, lurking monsters under the bed. Can we identify younger lawyers who are our future leaders? How do we train them? First identify them, then train them, and then nurture them. How do we give them those opportunities? Can you identify in your firm who the future managing partner is going to be? And then pick that man or that woman and make sure that they have the support that they need so that 5 years later or 10 years later, they will become a good managing partner. Years ago, when I first started working in law firms, I was advised, be nice to the first-year associates, because if you stick around long enough, one day, one of them will become a managing partner. Sometimes it's true. The managing partner in my firm started with our firm as a second-year summer associate. And 30-odd years later, he's now the managing partner. I wasn't there back then, but you can get the concept. You need to grow your future leaders. A woman by the name of Laura Stickler Ruclean, who is a lawyer, was a practicing lawyer, and is now a consultant, recently stated in the Harvard Business Review, in today's sophisticated law firm, these critical leadership roles cannot be conducted in a few hours a week. Law firms must place the same emphasis on leadership development that exists in business firms to ensure that the organization runs as smoothly as possible. Not only do partners need to own the firms, but they need to own their practices. Unfortunately, many individuals don't really care whether a particular client is profitable, as long as they bring in originations, as long as the numbers stack up in their column. So they may bring in the wrong type of client, because they like to do that type of work. They may say, I've got a $1 million practice, without recognizing that it took them $2 million worth of labor to create that $1 million worth of fees. The decision seemed to benefit themselves rather than benefiting the firm, and that's not what being a true partner is all about. Again, think back to the very beginning when I talked about individual behavior as opposed to group behavior and how we change that. And then think of everything we've been talking about. Being a lawyer is not what it used to be. Going to law school is not what it used to be. Recently, my daughter, who's a couple of years out of college, I've had the opportunity to speak to a number of her friends who have been thinking about going into law school. And my first question to each of them is, why in God's name do you want to be a lawyer? And I push them pretty hard to make sure that they understand what life in a law firm or as a practitioner, as a practicing lawyer is really like, and that the passion and the interest and desire is there so they're doing it for the right reasons. But law schools by themselves have become big business. And as I'm sure you know, because you have all the publications that come through your hands, they have been under terrific scrutiny from bar associations, from the press. They're being forced to look at what kind of training do they really provide, and how successful are they really in getting their graduates placed. They need to not only indicate what percentage of their graduates are getting jobs or are employed after law school, but how many of them are actually practicing law. How many of them are saying, how would you like your latte? Used to be the old, want fries with it? This subject has been in the press, at least in Boston, constantly recently. We've seen the changes in the tactics of law firms in terms of their hiring. Did you guys see, I think this hit the nationwide news, but there was a law firm in Boston that recently advertised looking for a first-year associate with an offer to pay $10,000 a year salary. And they had hundreds of resumes sent in. That's a scary thought. Many of the students are coming out of law school with tremendous debt, and there are simply fewer opportunities for them to get jobs that are going to pay it off. Now again, if you read the various stats, you'll hear that the starting salary for big law is still $160,000 a year. But the average salaries in most non-big law firms is probably closer to the $50,000 to $60,000 a year range. It's going to be hard to pay off $150,000 of debt with a salary of $50,000, $60,000 a year. We are seeing the lowest employment rate for lawyers coming out of law schools than we have seen in a very long time. And now, for the first time, we are seeing a decline in the number of applications that law schools are receiving. And at the same time, for the first time, law schools are now cutting back on the number of applicants that they are accepting. Now, this may be a good thing. It may be a self-selection process. And hopefully, we are getting the candidates that have really thought through, why do I want to be a lawyer? And is it worth it to me? And what am I going to do when I get out of law school? Hopefully, they're knowledgeable and realistic about their expectations. But for me, the monster, the thing that I worry about, with this change in process, change in expectations, are we scaring off kids who would be the future Brandeis, the future terrific Supreme Court judge who we may never get to see because they were scared off going to law school because of what they're seeing in today's marketplace? And then, when they do graduate from law school and they find their way into our law firms, how are we encouraging them to want to become partners? Is there a good role model that they're seeing that says, that's what I want to be when I grow up? Not necessarily. We recognize that life does not get easier when you become a partner. You're often working harder, or at least differently. The demands are not any less. And how do we encourage this next generation to want to do that, to prepare for it? Do we adjust our expectations of what a partner is? Do we find a way to allow for different work styles, for different compensation expectations? What do you do when a very talented attorney who you're seeing as the future of your firm comes to you and says, I don't want to work any harder than I already am. I'm happy being paid less. What do you do with somebody like that? That's your future. At the same time, much of our growth now is coming with lateral acquisitions. How do we effectively identify lateral partners? How do we evaluate them to ensure that their work ethic, their attitude, the quality of what they are doing really fits within your organization? How do you look beyond $1 million or $5 million practice to say, does this person really fit? There are many law firms out there who will say that they have a no-a-hole policy in terms of partners that they are bringing in. We've all talked about that. Everybody says it. And of course, we all grandfather the people that we have. How do you know, how do you really establish when you are doing a confidential search, how do you find out whether somebody's personality is really going to be right for your firm? It's what I think of as the cocktail party test for a partner. If you go to a cocktail party and you're standing next to your partner, are you going to feel comfortable saying to somebody you don't know, this is my partner, and be really proud of them in everything that partnership means? If you can, the quality of them as a person, their ethical standards, the quality of the work that they do, all of those different things, that's what being a partner is all about. But given the fragility of law firms these days, the increasing mobility of partners that we touched on a little bit before, considering mergers, law firm breakups, split-offs, layoffs, how do we maintain in our organizations the kind of firm culture that will be attractive to lateral partners, but at the same time will encourage our existing partners to want to stay? And then the monster of compensation. I touched on it before. How do we motivate the appropriate behavior through compensation? Is compensation a reward for past behavior? Is compensation a tool to motivate future behavior? We all know, or should know, that every behavior is motivated by something. It might be greed, or power, fear, compassion, logic, caring. How do we develop systems that will find the right motivational tools to encourage the kind of behavior that we want? The behavior that is in the firm's best interest, even if it's not necessarily in the individual's best interest. Again, we're still coming back to that theme of individual versus firm, individual versus group. Let's talk about human resources and benefits. A firm is only as good as its people. That's really all we have to sell. So what makes the difference between a good firm and a less than good firm? It's the caliber of the people. Attitude, communication, skills, attention to detail, confidence and caring. Do you really think that most of our clients can tell the difference between a good brief and an outstanding brief? Not really. What they can tell is whether an attorney returns a phone call, whether the attorney listens to them, whether the attorney makes them feel like they are the most important client, even when they're not. We need to understand how to keep our people. One administrator said, when you know that all of your assets walk out of the door every night, and one wrong move can take away your best people, how do you walk that line of retaining them without breaking the bank? And yet, the studies will say that compensation isn't the primary thing that makes employees happy. What makes them happy? Fairness, respect, knowledge, and growth. So we need to identify quality staff. We have to evaluate them and motivate them. I want to talk briefly, I'm going to skip ahead a little bit, to talk about multi-generations. How does that grow into that? We now have employees ranging from their early 20s to their early 80s. We have a broader range of generations than ever before. And we know that there are certain behaviors that are attributed to one generation as opposed to another, and we're not going to really go into that at all today. We've heard the differences, that boomers are different than Gen Xers, who are different than millennials. But regardless of the stereotypes, we know that every generation has its members who have a distorted sense of entitlement. We all know that every generation has its workaholics. We all have our rugged individualists, and we all have our team players. The challenge that we face is finding out what motivates each generation, because if we try to manage them in the same way, it is simply not going to work. What will motivate a 25-year-old is not going to motivate a 50-year-old, and yet we have to find ways to motivate them all. So managing the differences requires greater listening skills, compassion, understanding, negotiating, and communicating. We have to be able to set different expectations and then manage to those expectations. But what do you do when somebody is not performing in the way that you want? When a partner isn't producing, isn't living up to expectations, the first step that a law firm tends to do is to cut that partner's compensation. You guys may not be privy to partnership compensation issues, but that's usually the first step of what happens. We say, this guy or this gal's not working really hard, so we're going to cut their compensation. That poor partner, we're only paying him $100,000 a year. Really? $100,000 a year for working part-time? It's not a bad gig. I'm sure there are a lot of people here and outside this room who would grab that in a minute. We need to find different ways to motivate people and be willing to deal with the people who are not able to produce. What we have found is that compensation doesn't do it. You're not going to successfully cut somebody's compensation and motivate them to do something better. You're not working really hard, and we want you to work harder. So to encourage you to work harder, we're going to cut your compensation. Really? Come on. Another challenge that we face, though, is that workers are healthier and live longer and want to work longer. And yet the retirement savings that many have achieved over the years just aren't there. So many people may want to but can't retire. But in many circumstances among our older employees, some of them either don't want to or are unable to work at the intense pace that a law firm usually calls for. But they don't want to leave. They're not necessarily as receptive to change, to learning new technologies, to adapting. And the challenge we face that in a law firm or an organization where there is restricted growth, where our budgets are limited, if people are not exiting on one side, it makes it very difficult to have new people coming in on the inside. There was a comment that was in yesterday's American Bar Association weekly summary that talked about law firms who are not, the big law firms, who are not reducing the salary but are hiring fewer people, and talked about concerns about the aging of the population. If we're not transitioning new people into the industry, then our law firm industry is just going to get older and older and older, and 5 years or 10 years from now, that's going to be a problem. So we need to find ways now to avoid that. We talk about transitioning work from one generation to the next. Everybody agrees that it's a great concept. However, when it comes to transitioning your clients and your power, it's not quite as comfortable as it is when you're transitioning somebody else's clients. So succession planning doesn't work as well. The challenge for you as librarians is to recognize the generations that you are dealing with. We all think that the millennials, they grew up with computers, they're great at it. They may be great at doing searching, but they may not have the knowledge or the awareness or the perspective to know what it is that they're researching. They can find it, but they may not know what to do with it. How do we coach them and teach them to do what we want? Technology. When I was trying to find a picture that felt appropriate for this, I went, Siri, please find monsters and technology. And I came up with this. There was also an interesting hit that came up because it talked about a new software product for some development stuff that I didn't understand that talked about how do you create a moving monster. But to me, the image was using technology in a law firm, how many of us have created monsters that we didn't intend to create? Technology permeates every single thing that we do. There's rarely a minute that goes by in any given day in a law firm where you're not doing something that relates to technology. It changes our attitude. It changes how we think. It changes how we focus. I know there's a session later on this afternoon that talks about writing skills. How many would believe that technology has negatively impacted writing? Because years ago, anybody remember whiteout and corrector tape? Says the age of the audience. Think about when you had to write something out by hand and you needed to type it once and then fix it. You were very careful about how you constructed the written product. As soon as you could cut and paste, it went away. You didn't need to be careful because the 17th version of something was going to be a little bit better than the 15th version of something. It creates problems for the clients because they're paying for it. It creates problems with the quality of the work. And to me, the underlying challenge, it creates problems with the way you think about the product development or the law process. It also changes alternate fee arrangements, not just the cutting of costs. How do we reuse product? How do we create product? Technology impacts all of that. What is our place in the law firm? How much time do I have?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm up. All right.
Sorry.
No, that's okay. I'm almost done. So we'll have one last thing if I can take two more minutes. The technology impact that affects all of us. Is there anybody in this room who doesn't have some kind of an iPhone or a BlackBerry? Okay, one hand. The question becomes, it's great because we can always be in contact, and it's terrible because we can always be in contact. You can never escape, but you can work any place. You can work from home. You can work from the beach. You can work on the golf course. Your clients never know where you are. Don't have to know. But what does this reinforce? Individual behavior. You can't be part of a team if you never see the people who are on your team. So working remotely can be great. The technology enhances that. It gives you great flexibility. It creates great problems. So, sort of trying to wrap up now. With all the monsters under the bed, how do you sleep the sleep of an innocent babe? We all need to deal with change. There's no way around that. I'm just going to quote something that came out of your Spectrum magazine from the AALL. There was a comment that was made in the last issue of that that basically talked about change and how we have to demonstrate value. It applies to you and it applies to me. We have to figure out how the monsters affect you in the library and how it affects everybody else. In the back and forth section of a recent copy of the Law Library Journal, Christine Sellers, a research specialist at Nelson Mullins, said, being a good librarian involves adapting to change. Things change, get used to it. Be flexible, be adaptable. Make sure when you complain or you resist something, it's actually for a good reason. I'm not saying to change just to change, nor am I saying adapt to new technology just to do so, because techno-lust for its own sake is never good. When I asked the question to my peers, what keeps you up at night, one of them said, I may never sleep again. Certainly, the future of law firms is filled with challenges on every conceivable front. However, every day I need to pass what I refer to as my own sleep test. Every day I need to know that I have treated people fairly, that I have looked at things with open eyes and with a fresh perspective, that I have been open to understanding and managing change, able to do what needs to be done, and again, that I'm fair. If I've been fair, if I've done all of these things, then I can usually sleep at night. I may not know all the answers. I may not tame all of the monsters under the bed. But by working together rather than working individually, we can figure out how to manage these. And if we can all pass the test, then we can go to sleep and the monsters will go back under the bed. Thank you. anyone has any questions, I'm happy to stick around afterwards. Thank you very much.